Jewish women have met dark moments very much like this moment. It's not about the trauma, but it's about Jewish women who chose life.
The flag was hoisted before the world.
What does it mean to fight back? We have a long fight ahead of us.
Here I am.
Here I am.
Here we are.
Here I am.
Here I am with Shai Davidai.
Guests today are Julie Silverstein and Tammy Schlossberg-Pruer, co-authors of a new book called Chutzpah Girls. It's coming out November 25th, 2024. And the reason I know about this book, or the first time it came on my radar, is that I received an advanced copy of the book just to see what I think. Just the fact that someone would be interested in what I think about a book is already mind-boggling, and I'm so honored that that's the case. But I got this book. It's 100 stories about Jewish, strong Jewish women throughout history, past, present, and hopefully future. And I spent a week every night reading the stories with my son, who's 8.5 years old. And at some point, my son said, "You know what? You should have them on your podcast." My son, who loves podcasts about Greek mythology and about fairy tales and about superheroes and about history, when he said that, I had a glimpse of what's it like being a Jewish kid at that very moment. And I said, that is an incredible idea. So I emailed Julie, asked her, is this something that you do? Is this something that you would be willing to do? And she was so gracious to bring in Tammy, her co-author. So Julie and Tammy, thank you so much for being here with me.
Thank you for having us, Shai.
Thank you, Shai. We're so honored. And please tell your son he's our number one fan.
Yes. And
and you know that we wouldn't be Chutzpah Girls if we didn't ask you a question.
Go ahead. I love Chutzpah.
Love to know how you came up with the name for your podcast and what does it mean to you?
Yeah, here I am with Shai Davidai. I had two contenders for the name of the podcast. The first one was Facing Goliath, because I really felt like we are at this moment where we're facing this huge, immense fight everywhere, all the time. And I feel like I'm facing Goliath and I need help and I need wisdom and I don't know how to do this. And I spoke with a friend of mine who's in Israel, Eitan Chitayet, and he said, don't center your narrative around them. Don't make what you based on what they are, because then you need them to be yourself. So instead of Facing Goliath, I chose Here I Am. And Here I Am is a phrase that keeps coming up in biblical stories when someone is being called to action, either by God, either by their community, and they say, Here I Am. And I found that so important because we are all being called right now. Some feel like they're being called through religious paths, others through social justice, Jewish civil rights paths, but we're all being called right now. So here's my way of saying, here I am.
It's such a powerful pronouncement of your readiness to act, to stand up, to speak up. And it's certainly a call to action for all of us. And as you said, for those who, you know, speak Hebrew or those who read the Tanakh, they'll know that Here I Am points to the phrase Hineni, which, as you said, comes up numerous times in the Tanakh. As tellers of women's stories, we feel it's important to perhaps drape another layer of consciousness on that phrase. The phrase Hineni, the response Hineni, is used only in the Tanakh by men. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Moses, Samuel, and it's never used by women, which I think speaks to the patriarchal context in which the Tanakh takes place. We have men stepping up as leaders, men who are the communicators with God. That tends to relegate women to these supportive roles. And yet we see women stepping up very much in the spirit of Hineni with the same passion and the same readiness to serve throughout the Tanakh. We see Hannah, who offers up her son to serve God very much in the same way that Abraham says Hineni and offers up his son Isaac in the Akedah story, the binding of Isaac. Or we see Deborah charging forth to lead the people into battle. And we see this for Jewish women throughout history, the Jewish women who picked up the sword and met physical adversity, whether it was Tzivia Lubetkin, who was a leader in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, or her daughter, or her granddaughter, Roni Zuckerman, who was the very first fighter pilot for the IDF. We see Jewish women picking up the pen, who were intellectual fighters and legal fighters. We see women who are rescuers and women who are redeemers, women who are a universalist and fighting for the civil rights of all of us. So I think that it's important for us to, in the name of all Jewish women in the Tanakh and throughout history, to say, Hineni, Hinenu, here we are, here we have always been, and here we will continue to be.
I absolutely love that. I want to add another layer, if I may. When someone says, here I am, what they are not saying is, I was not here before. And I think the fact that we don't have female characters in the Torah saying, here I am, is not an admonition of their lack of action. In fact, it shows that they are there all the time. There is no need for them to come and say, here I am now. They are being called all the time, and they are unfortunately been relegated into supporting roles in the stories that were mostly told by men, but they had equal roles in everything. And I give my own personal experience where everybody sees me and says, look, it says, here I am with Shai Davidai. What you don't see is that 50% of everything that I've been doing since October 7 is my wife, Yarden Greenspan. She didn't come and say, here I am, Yarden Greenspan. She is just fighting there with me. So it's very important that whenever we look at a story, and if it's a historical story, a biblical story, a story that's happening right now, is that we also focus on who is not in the story. Because just because they're not in the story doesn't mean that they do not play an instrumental role in it.
That's right. And I think that that very much speaks to what we feel is our purpose as Chutzpah girls, to give voice to those stories that happened, but perhaps just weren't told or weren't shared.
So we're going to get to Chutzpah girls. But before we get to Chutzpah girls, I want to get to Julie and Tammy. And I'm going to start with a question that I ask every guest on my podcast. I'm going to start with Tammy. Tammy, what kind of a Jew are you?
Oh, wow. That's a loaded question these days. I think, you know, my natural association has always been to call myself a wandering Jew, not just myself, but as part of a family of wandering Jews. I personally was born in Italy. I grew up in Belgium. I currently live in Tel Aviv with my family. And, you know, these places are very different, not only geographically, but also in terms of what they represent. I think Jewish life in Belgium was a lot more sheltered, a lot more traditional. And I currently live, you know, in one of the most progressive and liberal cities in the Middle East. And so I think for me, it's always been walking that line between the past and the future, the old world and the new world, tradition and progress, wandering, I think, in that sense. but also having role models in my family of wandering Jews who, you know, sometimes were forced to wander due to persecution and sometimes out of choice and opportunity, but always met the occasion with, I think, an extreme strength of character and some might say chutzpah, and have definitely served as role models in terms of, you know, how I view the wandering. And I think that's essentially what we're trying to do with the book as well, kind of looking at our collective heritage, not only through the tragedy and the oppression, but also through the chutzpah and the strength and the resilience of the women in our heritage.
And we're going to get to the book and what is chutzpah in the first place. But Julie, how about you? What kind of a Jew are you?
Perhaps similar to what Tammy said, I see myself as part of a collective. It's hard to think of a single Jew, but I feel very much that I'm part of a continuum of a Jewish story that goes back in time and forward in time, just simply a link in a larger chain, a larger story. And I think that relates very much to what I see as my personal purpose, to be a storyteller, as opposed to someone who is an historian, who's focused on the past, looking back to the past, or someone who's an activist or an advocate who's fighting in the moment and looking to create a better future. A storyteller is someone who's in between, who's trying to tell a story to make the past make sense and have greater meaning to the current generation so they can move forward with greater strength and clarity and conviction. I grew up in the United States. I'm the product of two very strong female matriarchs. My father's family were proud Jewish atheists, intellectuals, academics. My fraternal grandmother was an Egyptologist. She studied and researched and taught ancient Egyptian history. My mother's side of the family were observant Holocaust refugees, arrived in San Francisco to rebuild their shattered lives. My grandmother sold shaitels for a living. And I think that the greatest compliment that anyone could ever give me is that I remind them of my grandmothers, that I'm somehow a product of the two of them. That's very much what I feel like. And my parents, who came from two very different worlds, met in the middle and gave everything that they had to give us a strong Jewish education, Jewish day school, Jewish camps, Jewish youth group. And it wasn't until I left the home and went out into the wider world and experienced anti-Semitism for the first time that I really felt like a Jew. And that was when I arrived in college and the roommate that was assigned to me, who had never met a Jew before, looked at me with great curiosity and said, "I've always been told that Jews have horns. Can I see yours?" That was my first day of college.
Wow. I've heard a lot of people recount such stories, but I've never actually met someone who was asked personally that question. What was your reaction? Like, first of all, we should say, because people listening in, Julie does not have horns. So, you know, but what was your reaction? How do you react to someone that says, "I've heard that you have horns"?
I think it's one of those moments that just takes your breath away. And it was a moment I wasn't prepared for. And I dismissed it jokingly. And I remember that night going to bed and feeling around and just making sure that they weren't there.
That's an interesting thing that you just said, that, that going to bed, checking if I actually do have horns. It's like when the hate is so strong and so normalized and routine. And this isn't like in the 12th century, this is the 20th century, I assume, when you went to college. Then you can't help yourself but think, am I crazy? Maybe I do have horns. Maybe I am, you know, as bad as they say I am.
I think it's a moment where you understand your place in the world for the first time. you know, you grow up with all that love and all that pride and all that cushioning, and then you step out and you see the world clearly, and you see your place in the world clearly. And I think October 7th did something similar for all of us. It removed the blinders.
So let's talk about that, because you've mentioned that you are wandering Jews, that you're observant Jews, atheist Jews, strong Jews, proud Jews, storytelling Jews. And those Jews, the two of you, decided to write a book called Chutzpah Girls. So tell me a bit about this book. When did you start writing it? Why did you choose to write this book?
For me personally, the idea came to mind when I had my first daughter, Amalia. She just turned 6, actually. But right after she was born, you know, we kept getting these little feminist books as gifts, which were lovely. And I really felt like I wanted to connect with her over the stories of her own heritage. And I kind of started imagining it and envisioning it. And then Julie and I met really by chance, but it felt more like fate or providence. There was really something there that, we were so aligned with this vision. Julie had a similar idea surrounding her children's bar and bat mitzvahs. And we really just, you know, decided to make it happen. And so we started researching, writing.
Make what happen?
The book. I mean, we both had the idea to write the book, but I think we both also felt that this should be stronger than just a book, that this should be a movement, that this should be, a platform for stories of Jewish women throughout history. And we really decided that we were going to create a book that was fully about women, but also by women. So we reached out to 12 female Jewish artists around the world. And we were lucky enough to work with some of the most talented and diverse artists out there. And what was amazing was that, you know, some of them ended up having personal connections to the women that they depicted, not even knowing to begin with that those were the women that they'd be allocated to. And so there's really this connection throughout the book that made it even more meaningful, I think, for everyone involved. We selected women really, throughout history from 33 different countries. And I think what's interesting here is that they're not biographical stories, but they really zoom in on a pivotal moment for every woman where she is faced with some sort of challenge or crisis. And she responds with chutzpah instead of letting herself be crushed by that moment. She stands up to the occasion. And these are not women who were born or groomed to be leaders or activists, but they stand up and they rise up in a moment of hardship, and they leave their legacy in that way. And I think, you know, when we first started this project, it was really to ensure that there would be more stories about Jewish women out there. But of course, as Julie said, since October 7th, this has taken on a completely different scope. And, you know, people are hungry for this Jewish content. I think that the conversations that we were forced to have with our kids over the past year, just explaining the reality to them, leaves us with a thirst for stories of Jewish heroes, and to make sure that our children know that we've been here before and we've prevailed and we will prevail, and to draw inspiration from these stories in terms of what can I do and where can I step up and what kind of chutzpah is right for me and where can I serve, based on the stories that inspire me, enrage me, awaken me. And that is really what the goal of the book is.
So I want to delve a little bit into that, because you've been working on this book for a while, and you feel like after October 7th, that horrible massacre, which should be noted, took on an extra level of sadism when it came to sexual violence and female victims, mostly Jewish female victims, not exclusively, mm-hmm. but mostly Jewish female victims. So it took on a different meaning to you. But at the same time, you mentioned that there was this new thirst. Why is there this new thirst from the audience for such a book, mm-hmm. such a project?
Yeah. I mean, you know, originally, as Tammy said, you know, we simply set out to create the gold standard book on Jewish women. And then October 7th happened, and so much changed for us personally. We both live in Israel. I live in Jerusalem. Tammy's in Tel Aviv. We were running back and forth with our families into shelters. Our children lost teachers. Our children's teachers lost sons. My son, Matan, my oldest, is 17. He goes to a school in Jerusalem called Himmelfarb, which lost half a dozen recent graduates, some of the beautiful young men who are now household names, Hirsch Goldberg Polin, Aner Shapiro, Ben Zussman, all of these young men went to my son's school. So this affected all of us very much personally, and it affected others who were working on the book as well. Moran Yogev, who's a Ethiopian illustrator, one of our 12 illustrators, she was displaced from her family's home in the north. So, you know, obviously that affects the workflow of a book like this, and how you're communicating and able to meet your deadlines. And we understood that the book would need to change, and it did. We had spent already quite a bit of time selecting the list carefully. We removed some of the women. We added new women. We wanted to include some of the heroines of October 7th, Rachel Edry and Inbal Lieberman. And I think what we didn't expect was how much the book would change us. So, you know, I think we all feel since October 7th such a deep sense of isolation. We don't know where we fit into the world. Are we part of the right? Are we part of the left? Is there even a place for us in the center? And as we continued to research the book and to write the book, we understood immediately that Jewish women have met dark moments very much like this moment and met it with chutzpah and audacity and creativity and courage and gone on and found a way to shine their light in the black. And I think that we often think about Jewish history being one of displacement, trauma, destruction. And what we came to appreciate was that it's not about the trauma, but it's about Jewish women throughout history who chose life and decided to go on, and sometimes in very mundane ways, to simply get out of bed and to continue living and to raise families and to have children. And sometimes it was in extraordinary ways to make contributions in their professional field in very exceptional ways. But it was Jewish women who chose life and said, Hineni, here I am, and I'm going to keep going. And so I think our hope is that through this conversation and through the book, that your listeners will take the time to learn about the stories of Jewish women and never feel alone again.
Yeah. And just to add to that, Shai, you know, to answer your question, I think you touch on a really important point, which is that Jewish women have faced a double level of discrimination throughout the ages, but also now they face discrimination as women and as Jews. And that is something that, you know, we have seen through, you know, the topic that you specifically mentioned now. We did not include those stories in the book because, you know, we wanted to make it age appropriate. But of course, that is something that we felt needed to be addressed. And that is why this book is so vital right now for Jewish women to be reminded of their power in a moment where they're being discriminated both as women and as Jews.
Yeah. And I think that highlights an important irony, or I would even go and say hypocrisy, amongst the very progressive extreme left right now in Western world, which for years has been pushing this idea of intersectionality, which I completely agree in. The idea of the intersection of each person's different identities. And that was done so that no one gets overlooked with their identity. And yet somehow, when the intersection of woman and Jewish come together, that's where the invisibility happens the most. Unfortunately, when we look at the reaction of feminist organizations in the United States, we look at the Judith Butlers and Cynthia Nixons and Angela Davises. And I want to ask, because you said that you have also learned about yourselves in making this book, both before October 7th, but also after October 7th. What is one thing that you could say you've learned about yourselves from this book?
That's a really great question. I think, you know, to me, what was remarkable to learn from these stories was to see how very often, how many, there are many different types of chutzpah. And, you know, different moments require different types of chutzpah. And even one person throughout their lives could have, you know, different callings. And there isn't one kind of chutzpah, and there isn't one kind of chutzpah girl. And I think, and, you know, at this moment in time where this war is really not just in Israel, but throughout the Jewish world is being fought on so many fronts, we can all contribute. There is nothing that should hold us back. Like many of the women in the book, they weren't, you know, they weren't born and groomed to be leaders. And so it's really about finding that spark within yourself that ignites your chutzpah to contribute in whichever way you can.
So my goal is for this podcast to not just, I mean, my goal is for it to be heard by every one of the 15.8 million Jews around the world, but also to break away from that and to every person, Jewish or non-Jewish, who finds it important to fight for Jewish civil rights, just like fighting for every other civil right, if it's race, if it's gender, if it's sexual orientation, if it's immigration, whatever it is. But then there might be many people listening in wondering, there's this word you keep saying that I'm not sure I know what that means, chutzpah. Full disclosure, my wife is a translator, and when she needs to translate Hebrew fiction into English that has the word chutzpah, she just spells out chutzpah. But what is chutzpah? What is chutzpah to you? What does that mean?
Can we hear what it means to you first, and then we'll tell you about our definition in the book?
Are you a professor? Because that's what we do when we're buying time.
Oh, yeah, I didn't know that, but I'm going to adopt that now.
I can tell you. I mean, so I think people need to understand chutzpah means brashness. That's like the closest that you would say in Hebrew. And chutzpah is not a positive thing. When I have been called chatzuf, being like you're like brash, you're too aggressive, maybe it's too overstepping boundaries, that's not a good thing. But when you pronounce chutzpah as chutzpah, it becomes something else. It becomes, for me, this go out and get it mentality, this, yes, you can take a no for an answer, but only after you have tried 1,000 times in 1,000 different ways and made sure that no is the actual answer. It means standing up for what you believe in, even if it breaks some social decorum. That, you know, if I believe that the president of Columbia University is enabling anti-Semitism on campus, going out and calling her out rather than going through the proper channels and speaking calmly and wearing a suit, to me, that's chutzpah.
So I think you make a very fair point in highlighting the fact that as any force or any power, it can be used for good or for bad. And, you know, we agree that there is a huge difference between having chutzpah and being chutzpahdik. And so I think, you know, in the book, in our introduction, we came up with our own definition. I will read it to you if that's okay.
I would love that.
So this is how we define chutzpah in Chutzpah Girls. a Jewish superpower, the daring to speak when silenced, to take action when others won't, to try when they say it's impossible, to persevere in times of doubt, to be yourself when it's easier to conform, to stand tall when made to feel small, to believe when it all feels hopeless, and to shine your light in the face of darkness. And then we continue with a quote from the Talmud, which is actually the only time that we've found the word chutzpah mentioned in Jewish sources. And this is how it goes. It says, Rabbi Zeira said, come and see what chutzpah the land of Israel has, that it produces fruit in barren land. And I think to us, that really sums it up, that audacity to thrive and blossom in the harshest conditions. And, you know, for women, I think that was a double struggle as women and as Jews. And so this is our definition of chutzpah. But I think the beauty is that there isn't an accurate definition, and that it can mean something else for every person. It can mean something else for in any situation. You know, sometimes chutzpah meant hiding your Jewish identity to survive, and then acting when you could, or knowing when you could act more openly. So it really depends on the situation. But it's like you said, not taking no for an answer, and feeling like you can stand up for what you believe in.
I would add even more. I like that. That quote from the Talmud, because it says producing fruit in barren lands. What does that mean? Well, yes, like it literally means like, you know, the Negev, like we're able to grow, you know, cherry tomatoes in the middle of the desert. But what it really means is being in a space where you're not supposed to be. Not supposed to be, not because you're not allowed there, but because it is extremely difficult and no one expects you to be there. Right. And that is part of the chutzpah. And especially when you talk about chutzpah girls, you know, women and Jewish women have been so excluded from many different circles and spaces. And sometimes just the presence is the chutzpah. Just the act of writing a book called Chutzpah Girls that is by women, writers and artists, but for everyone, not just for girls. That is an act of chutzpah. Mm-hmm. It's, I am going to be on that bookshelf, not in the Jewish section, but in the children book section, in next to that amazing book about Marie Curie, next to that amazing book about Albert Einstein, next to that amazing book about David Bowie that my son reads, we're going to put chutzpah girls, Jewish fighters. That is chutzpah.
And thank you, Shai. I also want to add that reading the book to your son is also chutzpah, and, you know, endorsing it is chutzpah as well. As a man, we feel like all chutzpah girls need chutzpah champions. And throughout the book, there are many stories where, you know, the male allies have really supported the women. And, you know, some of the examples, like Asnat Barazani, who was Rosh Yeshiva in Kurdistan, we're talking about modern day Iraq, and this was in the 17th century. And her father was the Rosh Yeshiva before her, and she succeeded him. And the condition when she married was that she shouldn't be allowed to take on any housework. This was a condition that her father set so that she could continue focusing on her studies, and out of respect for her stature. Annie Cohen-Kapchowski, one of the first women, the first woman to cycle around the world on her own, an Orthodox Jewish woman originally from Latvia and then from the U.S., went on this solo trip while her husband stayed home and watched her three kids. And, you know, throughout the book, there are many other examples of chutzpah champions. So thank you for your chutzpah de contribution.
I mean, it's funny that you would say that. I don't consider myself an ally, because allies help others in their fight. This is not someone else's fight. This is my fight as a Jew and as a person. And that, you know, they say, I have a very strong feminist mother, a very strong feminist wife. I'm trying to raise very strong feminist boy and girl. It's as much my problem as it is everyone else's. And I want to get into the actual stories in the book, because some of them are just Some of them I knew, but not all the facts and details. Some of them not. Before we get to the stories, I want you to take me through the process. Like, how did you choose the women that made the cut? And were there any women that almost made the cut, or you mentioned had to be removed? And should we be expecting Chutzpah girls too? Like, what? Tell me about their stories as well.
Well, we spent a lot of time thinking about this, the list of women, researching the women, and making sure that there were women that would be in the book that you would be familiar with, and that there would be plenty of women that you would be discovering and encountering for the first time. That was important to us. It was important to us that the women in the book would not be incidentally Jewish, but would be proudly and openly Jewish women that live their values and made Jewish choices. Through the selection of women, we wanted to be able to tell the Jewish story. So we wanted to ensure that there was geographic diversity and historical diversity. And we're including Jewish women who are Mizrahi, Sephardi, Ashkenazi, Persian, Indian, Ethiopian, and all in all came from over 30 different countries, women that made professional contributions across a variety of different fields, from the arts and entertainment to math and science. And our hope is that the greatest criticism that we receive for the book is, what about her? Why didn't you include her? You should have included her. Because 100 is nowhere near a complete and comprehensive list of Jewish women. We would love to be able to put out a second book, and that this should just be the very beginning.
Is there one Chutzpah girl in specific that you felt at a hard time not including in the book just because of space considerations?
We have a full list of those. And the stories just keep coming in, especially this year. They're endless, you know, what the women have done around the world, but especially in Israel. So there definitely needs to be a Chutzpah girl, 2, 3, a podcast. And, you know, that's our hope. There are many, many stories that are still untold, and we hope to tell them.
So let's delve into them. And we're going to mention just a few of them. Trying to get from more like chronological order, we'll start with like maybe the very beginning, the matriarchs. Before you tell me one or two Chutzpah girls from the matriarchs, I'm going to ask you a question that might be a bit controversial for some of my listeners. And I'm asking it not to provoke, not to offend, but really out of complete curiosity. Why include women from the Bible? Why not start with Chutzpah girls that we have other historical records of them? Why was it important for you to include that?
I think that's an excellent question. And I think, you know, this book is unique within its category in the sense that it is Jewish. And so we have that. We're fortunate to be able to link back to biblical times throughout our heritage, throughout our history. But I think it also poses a unique challenge. It's how do you make those, you know, more traditional Jewish values relevant to a generation that values achievement, fame, individuality? Those values don't always align with each other. And while there are, I think, biblical women who would align with, you know, our modern day view of leadership, whether it's the female warriors like Judith or the judge like Deborah or the daughters of Tzlofchad who spoke up for equality. There is something very foundational about the matriarchs and the values that they represent, which I think, you know, this year we have seen more than anything, in the mothers who have risen up from the darkness with the strongest force we have ever witnessed, I think, at least in our recent history. And I think a lot of their values were reflected, a lot of the matriarchs' values were reflected in the way some of these women led, you know, their campaigns. And just to to give an example.
I would say, I would just interject one thing. I think the greatest chutzpah girl of all in current times for me is Rachel Goldberg Pollan. And the going back 25 years, Israel used to have an organization that was mothers, started by mothers fighting to end the first Lebanon war, mothers of soldiers, and they were called Arba Imahot, four mothers, going back to the matriarch, four ancestral mothers. So I think you're really hitting on something here about that connection. So tell me about like a chutzpah matriarch.
So, I mean, you know, you brought up Rachel Goldberg Pollan, who is, you know, the ultimate chutzpah girl for us this year and will absolutely be included, not even a question, in the next book. And I think, you know, there have been many parallels drawn between her strength and the strength of the matriarchs. But I think for us, we really recognized it in the story of Lea Imenu. And her story is actually kind of tragic because it, you know, she's tricked into a marriage by her father to a man who loves her sister. And she tries to win his affections and it doesn't work. And she could have drowned in that misery. And instead, at some point, she chooses to shift her perspective to one of gratitude. And it says that, you know, after she gives birth to her fourth son, Judah, she decides that this time she will thank God. And she recognizes that giving birth is not a given. And many of the matriarchs, you know, were barren for many years. And for her, it was very easy. And she goes out and thanks God publicly. And the Talmud highlights this as a very pivotal moment. And it says that until Leah came and thanked God, nobody had thanked him before. And she introduces this foundational concept of hakarat hatov, of gratitude, one that we wake up with as every morning as Jews. We say modeh ani, that is really what we start our day with. And, you know, I don't think there's one person who didn't watch Rachel's eulogy for Hirsch, but even there, she recognizes that and she says, you know, I want to start with Hakarat HaTov and thanking God for giving me the honor of being Hirsch's mother. And this woman has every reason in the world, and it would be completely legitimate for her to turn to blame and to anger. And instead, she focuses on gratitude. And I think, you know, that is probably one of the most powerful examples that and the entire way that she has led, carried herself throughout this entire year, is probably one of the most powerful examples of why we included the matriarchs and why these values are not only relevant, but vital for us to survive, not just in this moment in time, but always, and how that should be the perspective that we adopt.
And in a way, I think by stepping up, by exhibiting chutzpah and with such poise and elegance, but also determination, she has become all of the hostages' mother. She has become all of our mother in a way, which she's gone beyond the family ties of motherhood to the stepping up to the role that is not defined by whether you give birth or not, whether you're told by someone that you are, you know, his isha or not. It's whether you step up to being the one that's holding the fort together.
Which is another parallel that has been drawn very often, comparing her to Rachel Imenu, who is, you know, considered the mother who had extreme compassion and, you know, called out for her children relentlessly, and God rewards her for that. And yes, there are definitely multiple parallels that we can draw. Mm-hmm. I think another one of the mothers that we have seen rise up with incredible courage has been Sarit Zussman, the mother of Ben Zussman, also originally from Jerusalem, a soldier who fell in battle. And we there was one part of her eulogy where she completely rejects the notion that there can be any moral equivalent between people who sanctify life and people who sanctify death. And it's just, you know, such a simple and obvious value that should be clear to everyone, but as we have seen over the past year, is not, even to some of the most educated people throughout the West. And to us, it really led an association to the story of Rivka Imenu, which is centered around loving kindness and a very simple yet clear moral clarity. She's defined as a lily amongst the thorns. She was raised in an environment of wickedness, yet she stands for something else. And she chooses to leave her familiar environment to join Isaac, who she knows is pure and good. And even as a mother, when she gives birth to twin boys, even with a mother's bias, she's able to see the difference between them and to recognize Jacob, the man of peace, and make sure that he is the one to receive the blessings and then lead the nation of Israel. And I think, you know, that clear moral clarity that clearly many people are missing today is something that we learn from Rivka. And the loving kindness that she exhibits, you know, Sarit herself also would have every reason to react differently, but she has channeled her pain into an incredible and inspiring initiative, which encourages people to speak kindly to each other, to eradicate extremists and hate speech from our society, to unify people. And so, you know, the values of moral clarity and loving kindness to us very much represent the values of Rivka.
So let's fast forward to another chutzpah girl now in Western Europe in the, I believe, 1500s, Dona Garcia Nasi. Who was Dona Garcia Nasi, and what made her a chutzpah girl?
Oh my God. What made her a chutzpah girl is the fact that she is able to adopt so many different forms of chutzpah throughout her life. You know, she starts out as a crypto Jew. She is born under a completely different name, Beatriz de Luna. Her family are converso Jews who have been expelled from Spain and moved to Portugal. And for the first years of her life, she's in hiding. They practice Judaism secretly in their home, but then outwardly.
What year they was act- this?
This is 1510. Mm-hmm. And, you know, outwardly they act completely. They're Christian, and she ends up marrying another crypto Jew, and together they build an incredibly successful trading company. And she's obviously very influential through their business success, and sadly widowed at a relatively young age. She then leaves Portugal for Antwerp, which at the time was a center of commerce and trade. And so as a businesswoman, she had more liberties there as a Jew, because they were able to have all kinds of deals with the government to not be persecuted. And so as soon as she's there and able to be a bit more free, she sets up this incredible escape network where she helps Jews from Spain and Portugal escape to the Ottoman Empire, which at the time was very open to receiving Jews. In the Ottoman Empire, you know, they recognized that the Jews were very productive members of society. They were the most literate, and so they wanted more Jews to arrive. And so she, together with her brother-in-law in Antwerp, set up this network to get Jews from Portugal through their trading ships to the port in Antwerp. From there, send them through the Alps. They had everything set up with secret codes.
So this is basically like the equivalent of what came later in North America of the Underground Railroad, right?
Which is, and there are other contemporary examples of this even within within Jewish history. Judy Feld Carr, who's a musicologist based in Toronto, saved over the course of 3 decades, starting around the 1970s, 3,200 Syrian Jews. And she did this by developing secret communications with the Jewish community in Syria, bribing Syrian officials, liaising between governments and nonprofit organizations, and managing and financing a secret escape network. And what was quite remarkable about Judy was not only that she was able to save over 3,000 souls, but she managed to bring out of Syria some very important Jewish documents, including the Keter, Damascus Tanakh, which was a 12th century Tanakh, handwritten beautifully in Italy. She was able to bring, to get a Catholic friend into Syria who brought out the Keter Tanakh in his coat. It came through Toronto, made its way to Jerusalem, and now today it sits in the National Library. And she did all of this as a single mother. She did not have the training to do this. She was a musicologist. She lost her first husband at a young age. She had three young children at home, and she managed to balance this incredibly courageous work with raising three children on her own, balancing a career. And I think it just it indicates just another level of courage and resilience in her own story.
It's quite incredible that both Donna Garcia Nasi and Judy Feld Carr, 400 years apart, 450 years apart, both young widows, both decide to, there are Jews in danger somewhere else in the world, let me get them out.
Let me get them out. And I think, you know, you see as her story progresses and she has more freedom to be openly Jewish, she doesn't just get out Jews, but she calls out the most prominent, you know, the Pope. She orchestrated a boycott of his harbor to create financial pressure to help make him release Jews that were imprisoned at the time. And I think to me, what is so remarkable is when you didn't have these liberties before. It's not that you had these liberties and they were taken away and then you decided to stand up for yourself. You were a Jew in hiding throughout your entire life. Where do you get that confidence to stand up against one of the most influential figures in Europe at the time and demand that he released the Jews? And I think to me, that is what is remarkable about her story. Even the psychological shift that needs to happen, that I, you know, I am worthy, like I can be a Jew openly and I can demand that the Jews are released when you've never had those liberties before and you've been used to hiding your identity for your entire life, I think to me was the most powerful element in her story.
So let's go from Chutzpah Girls saving Jewish lives to Chutzpah Girls saving the Jewish identity or narrative, I could say. What made Eliza Davis a Chutzpah Girl? Who was she?
Oh, Eliza Davis is definitely a Chutzpah Girl. Okay, so Eliza Davis is the champion of respectful dialogue, which I think, you know, in this day and age, is very rare to come by.
What country, what years?
Okay, so she was born in Jamaica and then moved to the UK. We're talking about late 19th century. She and her husband end up buying Charles Dickens' home. And Eliza Davis is the daughter of a Jewish cantor, raised in Jamaica. She is a mother of 10 children, a stay-at-home mom. And she moves into Charles Dickens' home and starts reading his books, which she absolutely loves, until she gets to Oliver Twist and comes across the character of Fagin, the old and shriveled Jew who encourages Oliver Twist to steal. And, you know, throughout the book, he is referred to as the Jew over 250 times. And she says how that is a stab in the heart to her every single time. And, you know, there isn't much information out there about her, but the little research that we found describes her as a very averagely educated woman, a clumsy writer, housewife, and she picks up her pen and writes Dickens a letter. And at first, she just asks him to donate to a Jewish charity honoring Miriam Montefiore, who's actually another woman in our book. They were building some sort of rehabilitation home in her honor. And then she calls him out and, you know, makes him aware of the negative portrayal of the Jews and how harmful it is to British Jews who have only recently been emancipated and are trying to integrate into society. And then you have Charles Dickens, whose literature has been so impactful, calling them and, you know, portraying them negatively. And the remarkable thing is that he responds and he sends her a check for the charity and he apologizes. And he said, you know, I'd never really met Jews before until I met you. And this was the portrayal that I had. And it seemed right to me at the time. And that was it. And she, I think, you know, many people in her situation would have just accepted the check, but she doesn't. And she writes to him again and she calls him out on the fact that he has a responsibility as such a public author to rectify this. And he takes it seriously and he does. And in the future editions of Oliver Twist, he switches out the character and revises the amount of time that he's named the Jew. And then in his future books, he even introduces a Jewish character that is noble and kind. And the exchange between Eliza Davis and Charles Dickens is actually the largest exchange of letters that was found between him and anyone outside of his immediate circle. So he really engaged with her. She sent him booklets about, you know, Jewish customs for him to really learn and understand what Jews are about and what they stand for. And at the end of this all, she commends him for atoning for his sin. And I think that is a beautiful message because, you know, we can change people's minds. And she recognizes that. And she you know, commends him for that as well. But I think just the fact that she was able to do this through respectful dialogue, which in our polarized world is something that is so rare and something that we rarely witness. And I think even the people who are able to engage in a respectful dialogue rarely manage to change other people's minds. And so the fact that she's able to do this just by writing him a letter and get him to actually act and rectify his wrong is truly remarkable.
It is incredible. And it does remind me a little bit of my own wife, Yarden Greenspan, who is one of my personal chutzpah girl heroes, who on October 10th printed some posters of the kidnapped hostages, who she helped actually create those posters. She wrote the text. She's a translator of the artist that did. She wrote a note and she gave it to Mark Ruffalo, who has a huge audience and has not been speaking up, said, "You have an opportunity. This is 3 days after the massacre." Unfortunately, unlike Dickens, Mark Ruffalo didn't rise to the occasion, but that chutzpah girls got to keep trying. Let's fast forward. There's so many that I want to talk about, but because of lack of time, I want to talk about two very, very different chutzpah girls from October 7th who fought in very different ways. Rachel Edri and Inbal Lieberman. Tell me about Rachel and Inbal.
That's right. I mean, these are two women in and of themselves who could tell the story of the modern state of Israel. Inbal and Rachel are born almost exactly 40 years apart. They're from two different generations. Rachel is the daughter of immigrants from what is now modern day Iran. Inbal grew up on kibbutz near Am. She's multi-generations on the kibbutz from an Ashkenazi family. They both portray very different dimensions of female strength. Inbal was a combat veteran in the IDF. And she was the very first woman to be appointed head of a kibbutz security in the whole southern Shar HaNegev area. And on the morning of October 7th, she is awoken by air raid sirens. She does not wait for instructions from the army. She goes and she opens the armory. She prepares the weapons. She gathers her 11-man volunteer security team. She positions them strategically along the kibbutz border fence. She runs door to door to make sure that families are sheltering safely in pace. And she's manages to hold off any infiltration from the Hamas terrorists for hours until the army comes. And
basically, she saved the kibbutz, and she's only 27, if I'm not mistaken. 20.
That's right. I mean, I think she was even 25 at the time this happened, and her story also has parallels to women from the Bible. You asked, why do we include matriarchs? Why do we include women that go so far back and not just contemporary women? And I think when you read them side by side, and the book is ordered alphabetically, so you're not moving from kind of black and white sepia tone history to the current day. You have this experience of encountering contemporary and biblical era women side by side. In Ball's story, parallels so much the story of Judith. Judith was a woman. She was a Jewish woman. She's a widow living during the time of the Assyrian Empire. Her town of Bethulia is under siege from the Assyrians. And rather than waiting for instructions or waiting for someone to come in and save her, she takes off her mourning gowns. She puts on a beautiful cloth. She walks out of the gates of Bethulia into the enemy camp. She earns the trust of the enemy general. And when he falls asleep, she unsheaths his own sword and takes aim at his neck, and in a single swoop, takes his life and goes back to Bethulia. She warns the Jewish residents of what has happened and to attack at dawn. And when dawn comes, they attack, and the Assyrian army is in disarray because they no longer have their general at the helm. And they flee, and the town is saved. And we see two women who took matters into their own hands. They took action. They both picked up the sword, so to speak, but they didn't wait for anyone else to save them. They took matters into their own hands. Rachel Edrei is a very, very different character. She very much uses the intuitive, nurturing strength of a woman to survive an extraordinary day in her home. She and her husband. So Rachel is. She on the morning of October 7th, she hears the air raid sirens going off. She runs to the public shelter in her town. She returns home, and Hamas terrorists jump through her window, and she is now faced with a very precarious situation with Hamas terrorists in her home. And she manages to entertain the terrorists for over 17 hours. She serves them tea. She serves them cookies. She sings them Arabic songs. One has a wound on his hand. She bandages his wound. She strokes his hand. So we see not a woman who's flexing her combat prowess, but someone who is drawing on the unique female strengths of a woman to nurture, to care, to feed. And this also has parallels in biblical stories in Yael and in Abigail, who encounters a very angry army and meets them with a peace offering of food and appeases them and is able to avert a war.
Both incredible stories in their own different ways. Before we end, I want to ask you, of everything that you've read, if you could give just one tip, each of you, just one point, how to raise a chutzpah girl. And a chutzpah boy as well. but how can I raise, how can I make my three-year-old daughter, what best can I do to raise a chutzpah girl? Tammy, what's the number one thing for you?
The number one thing I think would be to model it, and you're doing a great job, Shai, so we're not worried for your kids, but really showing them, I think really showing them that you, you know, stand up for what you believe in. And I think that that is probably what creates the best chutzpah kids. I think also having, you know, part of the reason that we created this book is visibility and being able to see and read and hear stories about other people that you are connected to at the end of the day. Because even throughout writing this book, you know, you come across people from countries that you're in or professions that you dream of being part of, and you didn't know that that existed before you were exposed to it. And so I think exposing your kids to the stories of other heroes, especially within our heritage, is important.
Incredible. Julie, how about you? Yeah. One tip.
Yeah, stand up, speak up, don't give up, and find of yourself a hero.
I love that. Stand up, speak up, don't give up. So every episode I end with what I've been calling a Jewish lightning round. It's a list of questions. There's no right or wrong answers. Just give me the first thing that comes to mind. You get one pass each, and I get to decide whether you get that pass.
Instead of the pass, can we turn the question back on to you?
We'll see. and whoever wants to answer first, just jump in. So, Julie, Tammy, what is one thing people don't know about you?
Well, we may look sweet, but we have a lot of chutzpah. It takes a lot of chutzpah to write a book, to get it published in this environment. So I think we would say to all your listeners who are writing a book or to that have one inside them, to grow some chutzpah and to never give up and to put that book out in the world just like we did.
Love it. Tammy, what is one thing people don't know about the Jews?
I think how diverse we are, and I think that's the beauty of it. You'll know if you read our book, but, you know, we come in all shapes and forms.
Julie, what is your favorite curse? It can be in Hebrew or English.
You may not know this about me, but I have five children, and so my youngest is only two. I always have little people around me, so I don't often get the luxury of cursing. So usually I'm limited to some kind of a trite, confined, polite oops. Oh, well, let's clean that up. We'll do better next time. But if no one were listening and I were all alone, it would be a wordless, guttural cry to shake the heavens.
I love that. This is for both of you. When was the last time you cried?
Oh, wow. I think for me, it was on September 1st. My daughter started the first grade, and I took her to school, and I hadn't read the news yet that morning. And then the principal, during their first grade ceremony, announced the news, and I kept it together for, you know, for the ceremony. And then I went home, and there was this very strange
I should say flood. September 1st was the day when we found out that 6 Jewish hostages were executed by Hamas.
Yes, yeah, so I was about to say that I there was a strange flood of pictures on the internet, you know, stories about the hostages and also pictures of all the people who had just sent their kids to school. And amongst those, there were also pictures of soldiers who had driven for 3 hours to the homes of some of their fellow soldiers who were killed, and they drove there to take their kids to school because their fathers couldn't be there for the first grade. And I think that day was just a nonstop flood of tears.
Julie, how about you?
I think it was Hirsch Goldberg Poland's funeral. And it hit me particularly hard because I think we have often a way of rationalizing away all of the victims of October 7th to say, oh, well, you know, we would never have been at a festival like a Nova Festival. That never would have happened to us. Or we don't live in Israel. We would never have been in that kind of harm's way. Or they're different from me in this way and that way. And the Goldberg Polans are so close to us. Our children go to the same elementary school and high school and Jewish camps. And there's no space between them and us. We are just the same. And it happened to them, and it could happen to any of us. And hearing her incredibly powerful words every day and at the funeral just hit me like a knife.
Agree. Tammy, if you could have any person over for a Shabbat dinner from any moment in history, who would that be?
We'd love to have you over, Shai. You know, whenever you're in Israel, you have invitations in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, I assume.
But there must be a chutzpah girl that you would want to have.
There must be a chutzpah girl. I don't know if I would want to have her for dinner, but I would love to be hosted for Friday night dinner by Flora Sassoon, a very famous Indian businesswoman who was also a very learned Jewish scholar, and she hosted the most incredible banquets where she had, you know, leaders from all over the world and prominent rabbis and politicians, and she conversed with them in seven languages, and I'm just so fascinated to experience that.
Laura Sassoon. Julie, what's your favorite Jewish holiday?
Passover.
What's your least favorite?
Hillel sandwich.
What's your least favorite Jewish holiday?
In Israel, Lag BaOmer. Too many bonfires, so bad for the environment.
Tammy, when do you feel safest?
When I can be myself.
When do you feel least safe?
I think when witnessing divide and baseless hatred.
Julie, what gives you hope?
Jewish women. May we each find a hero amongst them. Here. And be able to say in our moments of challenge, Hineni.
Hear, hear. Tammy, what's the first thing that comes to mind when you hear the words Jewish civil rights?
Wow. You know, my association is with civil, and it's not going to rights, but it's going to civil society and the way that civil society has mobilized itself this year. And I think that a lot of the civil rights will be coming from the grassroots and from the bottom up.
Finally, this is for both of you. Every episode, I urge the listeners to donate to one charity that does good in Israel or across the Jewish diaspora. Where would you want listeners to donate to this week?
That's such a beautiful question. I mean, we were really honored to receive endorsements from across the Jewish organizational world. Organizations like Hadassah, Jewish Federations, Lion of Judah, National Council of Jewish Women, Jewish Women's Archive, Jewish Women's International, Momentum. Did I say Hadassah?
I hope I did.
And others. And we would hope that your listeners will take the time to learn about these organizations and to consider donating to them. Whatever Jewish organization you're donating to, we hope that as a result of this conversation, you'll ask new questions. The question being, how will my dollar or my shekel impact the lives of Jewish women, raise up Jewish women, amplify their voices, and better tell their stories.
Where can people find Chutzpah Girls? the book, not in the world.
Chutzpahgirls.com.
Can you spell that out?
Facebook. Sorry?
Can you spell that out?
Yeah. Chutzpahgirls.com. And hopefully you'll have a link as well.
And Facebook and Instagram.
Facebook and Instagram. And please reach out. We'd love to hear, you know, who should be in the next book and who your favorite chutzpah girl is. Who's your favorite chutzpah girl, Shai?
Right now, my daughter. My daughter is 3 years old. She is teaching Yarden and I what she wants. And it's tough and it's annoying and it's exhausting. And I have never been prouder, because I know that if she can wear me out, which is not an easy task, then there's nothing that she won't be able to achieve in her life.
And what a beautiful example of Jewish civil rights, the ability to articulate what it is that we want and need to feel safe and to thrive as Jews in this world today.
Yeah. So thank you so much for first giving me of your time, but more important, for writing this book. I urge all the viewers and listeners to get this book. I've only seen the digital copy. I can't wait to have, you know, to get the hard copy in my hands, because the art is just so beautiful, and including, in addition to the stories. So I urge everyone to go read Chutzpah Girls. Thank you so much, Julie Silverstein. Here I am with Julie Silverstein and Tammy Schlossberg-Poor. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Shai. Thank you for having us.
Hi, I'm Michael Greenspan, Shai's father-in-law. I'd like to thank you for listening to the Here I Am podcast with Shai Davidai. Here I Am is recorded at The Cave Production House in Hackensack, New Jersey, and is brought to you in partnership with Abby Sophia and Adamit Productions. You can find us on Instagram, YouTube, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. I'd also like to extend my deepest gratitude to everyone at Adamit Productions for turning Shai's dream into a reality, and to all our donors and partners for their unwavering commitment to fighting for Jewish civil rights. Most importantly, I'd like to thank you, our listeners. Let's be honest, none of this would have been possible without your support and dedication. Showing up is half the battle. Thank you for showing up. Thank you for being there. Thank you for saying, "Here I am."